Imagine a world where the forest stretched from pole to pole, where the earth is hot, really hot. No ice caps, just lush tropical landscapes, even in Wyoming. And then something happens, something big. A burst of carbon floods the atmosphere, temperatures skyrocket, and life is forced to adapt fast. This isn't the future. This is 56 million years ago.
Hello, my name is Andrew Schwartz.
Andrew Schwartz is a six-year PhD student at Rutgers University in the anthropology department. But before he was studying ancient mammal teeth for clues about climate change, more on that later, he was just another kid obsessed with dinosaurs.
I was always a dinosaur kid growing up. I watched Land Before Time, I was in diapers, all of the dinosaur movies, documentaries, still very much a dinosaur person. And my father recognized this and was looking for places to take me. I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, and there really are not a lot of publicly accessible fossil sites. We have some dinosaur footprints, but you really can't collect them. And the closest place you could collect your own fossils is actually not far from where I ended up here in New Jersey. And kind of central New Jersey, you could find dinosaur age marine fossils, particularly shark teeth, marine invertebrates, some of the marine reptiles that lived alongside the dinosaurs. And after one or two trips, I was hooked. We would make a kind of pilgrimage every year. And I'm just one of those kids that never grew out of the dinosaur phase.
But paleontology isn't exactly a clear-cut career path, and Andrew initially thought he'd follow in his father's footsteps, medicine. That is, until he took a class on biological anthropology.
Which is the division of anthropology that deals with humans, primates, extinct human relatives, ancestors, and us, our evolutionary and biological history. And I was hooked. The professor that taught that class ended up actually becoming my advisor. That's Dr. Tiffany Tung at Vanderbilt University. And paleoanthropology is essentially paleontology for primates.
And this is where Andrew was introduced to something called dental microwear. You see, every time you chew, tiny marks form on your teeth.
These could be scratches, these could be pits, these could be furrows. A lot of different features, and it's getting constantly overwritten every few weeks or so.
Those marks tell a story. What you ate, how tough it was, even environmental factors like airborne grit. Now imagine that you could study those marks on the teeth of animals that lived millions of years ago.
And we can look at that microwear, those little tiny scratches and pits, and make inferences about your diet, because clearly some foods are harder than others. You know, a carrot is much harder than, say, a overripe peach. Or if you're biting into bones, it's going to leave a different signature than if you're biting into soft flesh. I was introduced to this field of investigation when I took a course towards the end of my time at college called Life Through Time, which is, it was the history of life from the earliest life forms to now. Obviously, great class, something I would absolutely want to take, even if it didn't relate to my field of study. And I was so interested in it, I spoke with the professor of this course, Larissa DeSantis.
For longtime listeners of the show, Dr. Larissa DeSantis was the expert that we interviewed about how studying ancient extinctions, particularly the Pleistocene megafauna extinctions, could inform conservation for quokkas.
She suggested, hey, if you want to work on some projects outside of the class, we have some openings, as well as a visiting researcher from Rutgers University, Dr. Rob Scott, and, he could show you how we collect dental microwear and how we use it. And that started a long chain of events that ended up with me here at Rutgers University doing dental microwear.
But before Andrew was studying ancient mammal teeth, he was looking at something a little more mischievous.
The Capuchins were my my first attempt at collecting microware. We could go out and observe what capuchins are eating. There are a few species of them, and they tend to be harder object feeders. They tend to eat really hard seeds and nuts compared to a tough object feeder like a howler monkey. Howler monkeys will eat a lot of tough leaves. So the dental microware is actually quite different. Well, we have two species of capuchin monkey. They're usually living alongside each other and they have slightly different diets. So we wanted to see, okay, can we look at dental microware and suss out significant difference between them? In the case of that one, we did not see any difference, which kind of opens the door for maybe there's another thing that's causing it. Maybe grit, which is how many exogenous particles, things like little bits of sand or quartz that are in the atmosphere that are accumulating even in, you know, the forests of the Amazon all the way from the Sahara, the amount of grit that is on the food that you're eating can actually contribute to microware as well. There's still a massive debate that we really don't have enough time to get into whether microware is being more affected by diet or grit or how large that grit effect is. But that we have some projects that we're working on testing that relationship.
Then there was the Wari Empire, a civilization that lived in the Andean highlands over 1,000 years ago. Could dental microware tell us about how their diet changed over time?
This was more of a temporal study of samples over a span of like 400 years. And we use other dietary proxies, Delta 13C, to look at their diets and see how they're changing. And we see a change in those stable isotopes. So we think, all right, would we expect to see a change in the dental microware? Maybe they're eating fewer C4 plants, less corn. We looked at the dental microware and we don't see a temporal difference. The people at the beginning of this period are eating relatively the same mechanical property foods as the people living towards the end. Now, their diets, when we compare them to, again, you need a living observable sample to know, all right, maybe this is just what people's teeth look like. When we compare them to the teeth of groups with an observable diet, they are considerably less abrasive than these people. They have features that suggest they're not eating these foods that have a lot of, you know, small, hard particles in them. And I'll probably be a bit more involved as we continue writing up that second paper. But it is very interesting stuff.
Who knows? Anyway, so, you know, like in fossils, kind of harkening back to paleontology a little bit, soft body stuff is notoriously difficult to learn the history about because of the fact that it does not fossilize so well and only fossilizes in certain types of substrate and things. And therefore we get these like misrepresentation or these biases in the fossil record that seem to suggest maybe there weren't soft body things. Or, oh no, they were, but you just can't see them in this kind of thing. With dental microware, is there like a hardness bias where it's like, Or is it like, so if there's not a lot of grooves and pits and things in the teeth, is that used to then infer and say, oh, then softer foods would have been what was eaten? Is that kind of how it works?
So when we use dental microware, we are specifically looking at the teeth that are being used to masticate the food. So we're not really, we'll often not look at incisors or canines or even premolars, though occasionally you can, depending on the question you're asking. When you chew your food, you form these wear facets, these nice kind of flat surfaces between, you know, your upper and lower molars. And these are forming on the surface, the occlusal chewing surface of your tooth. And over time, you're going to wear those down, you're wearing this enamel down, and you will eventually get to the softer underlying material, the dentin underneath. Thankfully, enamel, which is a mostly inorganic material that our body produces, is one of the hardest, most durable materials. It's one of the reasons that in mammal paleontology, most of our species are represented by teeth. Teeth are super good at being preserved in the fossil record because they're mostly rock already. And a lot of the times you'll have a fossil that is 50 or 60 million years old, and it's a relatively well-preserved tooth, and you'll have really nice, clear-looking dental microware. Now, when we get to the absence of features, for example. You know, it's great to have a nice scan and you see all these pits, you see all these grooves or lines or scratches, but occasionally we'll have teeth that we have a nice wear facet. This was definitely an animal that was chewing, but we're not seeing many features.
These discoveries, monkeys in the rainforest, ancient civilizations in the Andes, they all led Andrew to a much bigger question. What happens when the world itself changes? The Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, a period where Earth warmed by 5 to 8 degrees Celsius in just a few thousand years. Gigatons of carbon flooded the atmosphere, plants and animals migrated, some shrank, and some disappeared altogether. Sound familiar?
Around 56 million years ago, something happens. We have what's called a negative carbon isotope excursion. That means we can look at the carbon isotopes, the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13, and we see that the amount of carbon-12 at this time in Earth's history skyrockets. And we can track that with other isotopes, and we see that this was a global event. This was a global warming that may have only taken a few thousand years. So this is sounding a little familiar to some of your listeners, potentially. This is quite similar to what we see in the modern record of climate, in that lots of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases are being released. We're seeing really dramatic temperature rises. And throughout most of Earth's history, if we have temperature rises or falls, these are pretty gradual. It can take, you know, tens of thousands of years to affect mean annual temperature by a degree or two. This was over a few thousand years that we get this temperature increase. And we get these conditions that last for nearly 200,000 years before that carbon starts to be buried and we get the temperature starting to lower. This is accompanied by intense aridification in some places in the northern hemisphere. So these large subtropical or tropical humid forests become dry tropical forests. We don't have large rivers or lakes as often anymore. The forests are no longer closed. They're starting to open. A lot of plants start to either become extinct or they move northward. They go to climates, temperatures that are more suitable for them.
And the way life responded, it's written in their teeth. I guess you could call it a tooth story. I'm sorry.
The mammals are responding quite dramatically to this period in Earth's history. I'm particularly focused on what's happening in a place in Wyoming called the Bighorn Basin, which is an incredible site for fossils, especially from the time around the PETM. And we get, extinct groups that have no close relatives or descendants, but we also get some of the first representatives of modern groups. We get the first perissodactyls, which are the toed ungulates, the horses and rhinos. We get some of the first even-toed ungulates, things that include deers and antelope and giraffes and bovids. We get some of the first true primates that appear right during the PETM. And some of these mammals are responding in ways that are different than the other mammals to this increasing temperature. Some of them are becoming extinct. We have minor extinctions of some of the land animals during this time. Some are spreading around the globe. We get the first primates in North America, Europe, and Asia almost at the same time. Some of the records outside North America aren't great with stratigraphy, so we're not entirely sure, who's coming first. But in the PETM, we have primates of similar species essentially on all three continents. So they're clearly able to migrate across these large land masses through probably continuously unbroken tropical forests. And some taxa, we have really good fossil records of these animals living before, during, and after this climatic event. So we can look at how microevolution is happening, how these populations of animals are changing over time.
What this tells us is that size matters.
So you have a 10 kilogram, little hoofed mammal that during the PETM is only about 5 kilos now. And that is a pattern we see represented in multiple taxa of different phylogenetic affinities across the PETM. But once you lift those conditions, you kind of return to a pre-PETM world.
If it gets hotter, you might need to get smaller, because smaller body mass comes with a greater surface area to body mass ratio, allowing you to better dissipate heat.
Actually kind of an expression of what's called Bergman's rule.
Essentially, it was this guy in the mid-1800s who said that, generally speaking, animals that were closer to the equator tended to be smaller than those living at higher latitudes, which were more rotund and had larger body masses.
Body mass is, obviously cubed versus surface area, which is squared. So you are getting bigger, your body mass is increasing disproportionately to your surface area. So it pays to be smaller in warm climates to dissipate that body heat. And at cold climates, it pays to be larger so you can insulate that body heat. Now, Bergman's rule really should be called Bergman's trend, because we have tons and tons of examples to the contrary. But we can use kind of this idea of increasing temperatures having an impact on body mass in the fossil record as well. And we could trace it as temperatures get warmer, animals or lineages tend to become smaller. And then when it gets colder, some lineages tend to be bigger. But it is quite a bit more complex than just high temperature, low body mass. There's, resource availability or water availability as well that is having an impact on body mass.
And that brings us to today. If global temperatures continue to rise, and they will, could modern animals start shrinking too? The fossil record isn't just a window into the past, it's a warning for the future. What survived, what didn't, and what does it tell us about the choices that we face now?
A quote I recently read that I might paraphrase is, "The past is how we understand the present and also how we may predict the future." To be able to understand the great diversity of life and how life reacts, how life evolves, how life adapts, we need to look at the past. And when we understand the past, we can make predictions about the future. The reason, or at least one of the reasons, that the PETM is both a very interesting time and a very alluring time to study is exactly because of what we're experiencing today. With the Industrial Revolution until now, we've seen global warming trends of, I think it's around 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, which might not seem like a lot, but you've got to understand that these are global mean temperature rises that are putting the rate of the PETM to shame.
What took the PETM thousands of years to do, we've done in a couple of hundred years.
The body mass of animals, or how animals are reacting to increased temperatures, how their diets might be changing, how their generation times might be changing, how their body mass might be changing, how they're evolving over time to increasing temperatures, can have huge impacts to our biodiversity today, as well as things that people might think are more practical.
Take, for example, livestock.
You have this industry of raising livestock for the maximum meat yield, for example. But as temperatures become warmer, we would expect these animals not to be able to dissipate heat, and we may have more livestock losses of these large individuals and selection for a smaller body mass. And you can say maybe that's not going to have as much an impact in industrialized places that are more developed, that have access to cooling systems for cattle, but a lot of the world doesn't. A lot of animals are raised for meat, just kind of a bipastoralist, and you'll see possibly natural selection and artificial selection, that is by people, coming directly at odds as we increase the rate of global warming and what impacts might have on our biodiversity. So you make areas warmer. If animals are able to adapt and become smaller, that's going to have an impact on the entire ecosystem. You know, a smaller animal is going to potentially eat less food, or it's going to provide less food for other animals that live alongside it. That could put some species that are already at risk of extinction at greater risk. That could put some species that we might see some divergence in species. You know, we might see speciation occurring alongside this, maybe different strategies of dealing with temperature increases. And the PETM allows us to study at a really fine scale. You know, 200,000 years might sound like eons, and to our brains it is. We can't comprehend just how vast deep time is, but having these really good records and being able to actually study microevolution in the fossil record over a span as long as 200,000 years really gives us a great ability to predict what may happen over the next few hundred years, which is something that is directly a huge concern for us as a species. So when we look at body mass trends during the PETM, one of the things we need to consider is how these trends compare with their, you know, animals that are closely related to other animals or across different groups. And one of the things that's kind of difficult to map out is, especially in Wyoming, we have taxa that had been evolving and living in North America for millions of years, lived through the PETM and after the PETM. That's very easy to at least see, all right, what's the size before the event, during the event, and then after the event. But we also have almost the spontaneous appearance or initial appearance in North America of a lot of additional groups. We get the first really basal horse. It's a really tiny little guy. Used to be called Hyracotherium. I think now it's called Cephripus or Eohippus. But they kind of appear almost out of nowhere right during the PETM. And because we have a really good record of them across the sediments of the PETM, we can see that they're not just reducing immediately. There's actually a point where in the PETM, they're becoming smaller, smaller, smaller when their temperature is at its projected highest. And as the temperature slowly begins to cool, the body mass starts to increase again. With some other taxa, particularly some of the native taxa that were already in North America, we don't have maybe the best stratigraphy, either due to not having the best collection site, or we didn't take the appropriate stratigraphy to see when that body mass is changing. But we can tell that it might be a different pattern than what the immigrants are doing. We don't necessarily see the body mass change from very small body to larger after the PETM for most of the primates. It seems to just be speciation, and then you start to get some larger forms. This could be that maybe the selection pressures for primates during the PETM were different. Most of the primates were absolutely tiny, maybe 100 grams, 200 grams, no more than a kilo, so about 2 pounds for most of these guys. So becoming smaller as a 1 pound primate is probably not providing that much of a benefit compared to going from 10 kilos to 5. Really an interesting phenomenon that it affects some species, then it affects others differently, or doesn't affect them at all. And knowing about this resilience or why animals are able to change is one of these questions that can give us predictive powers. Maybe the ones that are becoming smaller are more adaptive. They're able to change quickly and evolve quickly to have those smaller body size. And maybe the primates essentially just got lucky. Their food supply of fruits and insects were always available to them, so they didn't have to. We didn't see selection pressure favoring smaller body masses.
For anyone who is interested in a career in anthropology, what would you advise them?
So some of my best advice, and this is at least from my experience as a relatively early academic and really reaching back to my years in college, is the value of a very diverse liberal education exposes you to a lot of these interesting topics that you may have never given a second thought about. When I teach Intro to Human Evolution, a good majority of my students are not anthropology majors. Some are minors. A lot of them are taking it because it's a core science requirement. And many of them might just take it because it's a class to fail or maybe it sounded interesting. But I try to make it my mission to link whatever their interest is to anthropology. Because anthropology as a discipline is so all-encompassing that I've been able to link computer science, economics, mm-hmm. politics, literature, and all many different topics to anthropology. And really getting people first acquainted that the field even exists is a pretty difficult step. But once you're there, you can really get them interested and get them asking questions. This is what science has always been, is the inquiry, not just the why or the how, but mm-hmm. how did these things, you know, come to form? I tell students that your best cheat sheet when we have a lot of these tests is your own body. You know, when we are asking things about dental formula, so how many teeth you have, you are your own cheat sheet.
Yeah.
And that gives yeah. them, it makes it personal to them, and it gets you asking questions about your own biology. You know, why, a great question that I kind of pose to the students is, why do we have large butts? Why do we have large gluteal muscles? Because most other primates have limited muscle mass for, you know, behind their pelvis. And when you sit down and think, okay, why might that be something that we evolved? Well, it's under the selection pressure of walking upright. It's kind of an adaptation for supporting all those muscles needed to stride forward. And once you start thinking about those questions and appreciating your own form, then it opens the door to more questions. Okay, we have that. Do other primates, you know, were their ancestors like that? Or what happens when primates try to walk on two legs? And once you start asking these questions and you gain this interest, a lot of the rest of it starts to come naturally. No longer is it, oh, I'm taking this Intro to Human Evolution class because it fills a prerequisite. It's, oh, I'm taking this class and then I'm taking anthropology of food and diet and then I'm taking history of paleopathology, because they're helping to answer questions you have about yourself, about your family, about your history, about human evolution. And really, the wheels just continue to keep on turning. You everything kind of piles on. And with anthropology, a lot of these positions tend to be in academia. They tend to be research and teaching others about human evolution. There are some positions, especially with state archaeologists, whenever we find Native American remains, usually have to have a state archaeologist on hand to both determine the historical significance as well as work the tribal authorities into the mix. You can have anthropologists that are working with companies that understand things like human evolutionary psychology. How should we design this product to look, and why would it look good this way? What is going to cause our customers to want to buy this over something else? That may sound like psychology, but at the root of psychology, there's often the evolutionary impact of it. Why might we think of the red color of a certain product is more delicious looking than a black colored product or an orange-colored product? And that falls under the umbrella of anthropology as it's concerned with human evolution.
I appreciate so much you talking about the relevancy piece. I think that's a sign of a good teacher right there. Because as a high school teacher, I mean, that is so key. It is so key to be able to get people involved and in thinking. And really, like what you're kind of talking about, like embracing your inner toddler there with like those endless chains of why, you know, just why is this? Why this? Like for some reason, I don't know. I can't imagine college age, but it sometimes it's just so hard to get people started on that why and getting to look at things and wonder why. But you're so right. Like once you do, it's like dominoes. You know, it's like suddenly you can't stop asking why about all these different things. And there's all these ties, there's all these connections.
It's when people ask, you know, are we ever going to figure out the answer to all the questions? Are we ever going to find every single dinosaur? Are we ever going to have a completely unbroken chain of human evolution? And I say, even if we had all of the specimens in the world, we had everything available to us, answering one hypothesis, answering one question, literally breeds a bunch of more questions. Once we test a hypothesis and we see, okay, that's correct, why is that correct? Is it correct and is it applicable to other taxa or other situations? Let's try that. And science breeds more science, which is one of the greatest parts of doing science, is that you're never going to know everything, but the process of learning how things work and learning how all-encompassing everything is and how things are together and inevitably linked is one of the reasons that I feel my career choice as an anthropologist is incredibly rewarding.
That is all for today's episode of The Wildlife. Big thanks to Andrew Schwartz for sharing your research. And if you're fascinated by this like I am, you can check out the show notes for more resources. And as always, stay curious. If you'd like to support the show and the work that I'm trying to do here, you can do that at patreon.com/thewildlife. I also recently started a Substack if you'd like to subscribe to that. The link is in the episode notes, but it's just The Wildlife with Devin the Nature Guy. Keeping it simple. Take care, and peace out, Rambo Trouts.